Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Up Your Brave show with Natalie Cutler-Welsh on Reality Check Radio. I'm so thrilled to be introducing my next guest, who is bringing us some incredible information from a conference she's recently attended in America. I'm talking to Emily Hall on the topic of everyday ways to support a child with autism. Welcome, Emily.
Hi, nice to be here.
It's so good to connect with you and share some of your reflections. If for those of you that don't know Emily, Emily changes children's lives. She helps children with chronic medical, developmental, and feeding difficulties achieve their highest potential. She uses her extensive knowledge and experience from her former career as an occupational therapist and feeding therapist in the USA, in combination with qualifications as an acupuncturist specializing in needleless techniques to help all kids lead their best lives. She's based in Auckland, but helps families outside of Auckland via video communications. She has no affiliation to the Autism Health Summit. Well, I am so thrilled that you reached out to me, and I have a very soft spot in my heart for kids. So I'm really excited to hear the wisdom that you're sharing with us today. Before we get into those practical things that people can do, can you give my listeners a little bit more of the backstory of your journey towards helping so many families with autism?
Yeah, so I have always been interested in special needs from like being in primary school and intermediate school as a child myself. I volunteered in the special ed department, and I loved it when I was in school. And so that kind of carried on throughout my own training as an occupational therapist. Like through school, I worked at a nursing home for people with developmental disabilities, and I worked at a regional traumatic brain injury center. I studied OT, and have always like worked at least some in pediatrics. And kind of autism, when I started working in the 90s professionally, was hardly a thing. Like I was the only occupational therapist for an entire school district in Chicago. And there was one spectrum-y kind of kid and one with Fragile X. And that's a genetic thing that can present a bit similarly. And like after a few decades, the population of special needs exploded, and autism was chief among those that just went up exponentially. And I started asking questions, and I wasn't getting a lot of answers in Western medicine at all. And I kind of went to acupuncture school as a like continuing ed for my existing career. And it's given me like a lot more answers and a lot more potential strategies to help.
For our listeners that might not know what autism is exactly, can you explain how it presents? Or I don't know if there is a definition as such, but can you explain just the basic fundamental of what is autism? How does that present?
So what autism is kind of a changing thing, which was one of the exciting parts of the summit. But in most like mainstream systems, it's still focused as a like the DSM, which is a psychiatric diagnostic model, is listed in there as someone whose key characteristics tend to be lack of social skills, but it can also include problems with developmental like delays of different sorts. It can present with what are called sensory differences, where your perception of what's coming in through your ears, your eyes, your mouth, your joints, all of these things are perceived differently than would be typically expected, and your reactions can be, they would say, like they call it neurodivergent now, but it would be an atypical reaction to sensory input.
Okay, so this is something that people would normally notice or pick up for their kids in the early years, anywhere from what, age 1 to 5? Or
so there's two types of onsets of autism generally. One is there's something been a little bit off from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And the most common type is a regression type, where sometime in early childhood, the development gets, you know, less typical or very, very less typical.
Right.
After usually in early childhood, sometime between late infancy and most of the time it's picked up before 5 anymore. It used to be a bit later.
So parents would be like, they were doing fine, they were hitting all their milestones, and now they're not doing this anymore and they're not doing that. So that's regression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like they start talking and then they just stop.
Yeah.
Or they are socializing and then they seem to just get lost in their own world.
Yeah. Well, thank you for covering that. I think it's really good just to give a bit of an explanation for some of my listeners will know. I mean, I don't know if most people know somebody, but I know a lot of people who have a child that is autistic, but I think a lot of the times we don't exactly know what that means. So thank you for expanding on that. I would love to talk about the conference. So you've recently come back from this Autism Health Summit. And yeah, we would love to hear, what are some things that you realize? Is there anything that stood out to you straight off that you hadn't realized before?
Well, I guess I've realized it, but one of the really exciting parts about the summit was definitely a wider acceptance of what autism is. So what I talked about just previously is kind of a bit of an outdated model now, because even in the mainstream community, there's definitely more acceptance that this is a whole body thing. Like there's lots of things going on besides, you know, limited speech or language skills.
Right.
Or, you know, a little social quirkiness, that there is a lot more awareness of inflammation and where that inflammation might be happening, and potential autoimmune kind of responses in the child's body. And my near and dear is the growing awareness that autism is very much a motor problem, like a problem organizing your motor skills and controlling your motor skills. So there can be a lot of, like one of the mothers at the conference talked about her son, and they would go to a restaurant and he had a tendency to grab fries, hot chips from other people's, like people they didn't know.
Right, right.
Their plates or their trays or whatever, which was a very problematic thing. But as he was able to communicate more, he explained to her, I know I shouldn't do that. I cannot stop my body from grabbing the hot chips. Wow. And they were able to problem solve around that. But the communication was the start.
So something that surprised me, I know you sent me a little bit of information before the interview, is a statistic that autism has doubled in the USA between 2012 and 2022. And how common it is, 1 in 25 boys, 1 in 36 children. Can you talk to me a little bit more about that, about the statistics and the rise that you've noticed as well?
So there is definitely a humongous rise, and some people write that off as just changes in diagnosis. Mm-hmm. That's not just it. Some of that is, you know, people that used to be considered just quirky or, you know, kind of eccentric in the past.
Yeah.
Yep. Some of those may, like now in retrospect, be autistic, but the severity of what I see in the mainstream medical model is much more extreme than it was when I started working. And it's not just because I'm a more experienced therapist.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's what we're noticing is a massive rise, as you said, and part of that may be the diagnoses, but that does not account for the massive rise. Let's dive into some practical things, whatever you've seen in your own practice, but also anything you gleaned from the conference. What are some practical tips or strategies that you can share with my listeners, especially if they are or have families who are a bit overwhelmed as they might be? How can we support them? What are some practical things they can do?
So there's lots. One is just getting hope. And so for one of my favorite things of all time at the moment, and this kind of links in with autism as a motor problem, is spelling for communication. So there is a technique that was developed by an autism mother called spelling for communication. And it acknowledges that in extreme autism, so these are non-speaking individuals that have not responded to lots of other more traditional speech and language kind of interventions and therapies and communication devices and all the things. She uses really big stencils of letters and a pencil. And she uses a pencil because of the eraser, like the metal part on the eraser. And she found with her own boys, she has two autistic sons. And then it was so successful for them, she started teaching other autism families. And now she has this like multiple clinics and there's a documentary about her.
Wait a minute. With the eraser on the top, what is that? What's that about? The metal on
the eraser? So the eraser on the top is because when it goes through the stencil, it gives feedback.
Right.
So it starts, it's like rumble strips for communication.
Okay.
So when the speller puts the pencil through the stencil, it's the eraser end starts like giving them some feedback because they feel it shaking.
Okay. Yeah.
And then they can go and spell whatever they're trying to communicate.
Oh, cool.
And for whatever reason in this non-speaking brain, it seems like they learn to spell when, picture communication or other devices don't work for them.
Mm.
So for for non-speaking people, I highly recommend and even people who are remotely interested, watch the movie Spellers. I shared a link in the document. You can watch it for free.
Okay.
And it's just so hopeful. And I think that's the most important thing for families is to make sure that they have hope. And when you have hope, then you can be motivated to like do stuff.
Mm.
If you're like, oh, there's nothing I can do anyway, you're kind of stuck.
Right. So we're not resigned. I will put the link, by the way, on the replay page, you guys. But if you want to look it up, you might be able to remember this. SpellersTheMovie.com/watch. And you can watch that movie.
Other practical takeaway things that parents can do is get help. Sometimes like professional help can certainly be helpful, but also just ask for help from families, get some respite care. And other parents are like the mom hive mind is amazing, amazing, amazing resource. Connecting with other families experiencing similar things is so, so, so helpful. And I highly recommend it. And you like generally you can do it for free, either, through social media or through local community groups or what have you, through your school.
Mm, absolutely. So they know they're not alone. Something else you mentioned in your notes was around limiting chemical exposure. Mm. What do you mean by that?
So in the biomedical world, especially, there's an acknowledgement that autism can be a problem with detoxification. And one of the things that's not detoxifying is chemicals. And we know from just very standard statistics, like actuary data, that developmental problems can happen to anybody and any family at any age, but there is definitely higher risk. So for instance, professionals that work with a lot of chemicals, such as hairdressers. What I've noticed in my own early intervention practice is nail techs.
Mm-hmm. Would it be them or their children that end up having autism?
There's a higher incidence of their children having problems.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Tradies that have a lot of chemicals in their work have a tendency to have a slightly higher percentage of developmental problems in their children. We know that certain locations that are high in chemicals tend to have higher incidence of developmental problems. Places like factories, coal burning electrical places, fracking sites, they all are shown to have higher incidence of problems. So that tells me if we know that higher chemical professions and locations have higher problems, that it's better for our homes to have less chemicals where we can control things.
Mm.
So yes, we have to go around factories sometimes, or we may not be able to change our location, but in our home, if we can use vinegar and water instead of a harsh chemical, or less toxic chemicals in our garden, or just a little grease, elbow grease,
yeah.
and pull some weeds rather than spraying them,
yeah,
it tends to be better.
Because it can all add up, and the body absorbs so much through our skin, don't we?
Exactly. So that is, if we, what I see, or what my gut instinct is this increase in developmental problems is a combination of lifestyle things, including increased chemical exposure.
Right. Okay. And you mentioned about
lots
detox.
And lots of things.
Yeah. And you mentioned about detox. So we won't go into it here, but I think on some of my other interviews, which I will link in the replay notes as well. If you liked this, you might also like that. We have talked about detox in the past. So if someone has been exposed to a lot of chemicals, there are some things that they can do. Just saying this, so if someone is wanting to start a family and they feel like they've been exposed to a lot of chemicals, it might be a good idea to do a detox. Is that so?
Yeah. And there's lots of information, and that can be super helpful. I guess as an acupuncturist, one of the things that I look at is, why isn't the body detoxing?
Mm-hmm.
So people that I tend to work with have not responded well to either Western medical care in that regard, or even Western herbalism kinds of ideas. And in Chinese medicine, there's this idea that if the organ systems aren't strong enough or aren't balanced enough, then you're going to not be able to detox as well. And so some of it is actually strengthening the body to do what it should be doing,
mm-hmm.
and taking stuff out that the body might not be able to cope with.
That is such a great point. Okay, so strengthening the body or the organ that's not functioning as well as it could, and that will bring the body back into balance as well.
And I think for me, this is what's really unique about Asian style medicines, is there are a lot of concepts of how you might make your liver stronger rather than going in and trying to put stuff into it to make it do something.
Yeah. Do you know one way offhand that we can make our liver stronger?
I mean, there's acupuncture is one. Don't needle kids, but using those channels and using body work,
mm-hmm.
it's one way. And it's not just any body work, but for instance, working with the nerve roots that go into the liver helps open up the electrical pathways from the power source into the liver and can help it function a little bit better. The thing that I love about Chinese medicine is the concept is, whatever you got, you can make it work a little bit better. It yeah. might not work better fast enough for an emergency situation for sure and for definitely. But if you've got a long lingering stable thing, it does help it work a little bit better. And it's a snowball effect. You can make it work a little bit better and a little bit more. And so on until it can get a lot better.
What are some other things that families can do to support their autistic child?
Another really basic, often under-recognized, is sleep. And I do, when I say these things, I do understand that having a child with developmental problems can be really challenging. And so when I suggest this thing and you're like, my kid never sleeps, if it's in the too hard basket, that is not the right strategy for you. Ignore that and focus on something that you can do. And then you can get your own snowball effect. Like, you know, if you can limit your chemicals, great. If you can't, then go down on the list and do something that you can.
Yeah.
So if your kid never sleeps, this probably isn't the right place to start. But if your kid does sleep, getting on a good sleep schedule is huge. I worked with these twins in early intervention. So that's birth to three when I worked in Chicago. And they were both definitely headed for an autism diagnosis. Like, absolutely, they were spending a lot of time flapping and not talking, and development was way off.
Did you say flapping or clapping?
Flapping. So sometimes we used to call it stimming, where a child would have a repetitive, non-functional behavior that's essentially trying to block out the world.
Right.
And so sometimes they will shake in front of their eyes and rock, and that's trying to calm themselves down. So now we tend to call it self-soothing or self-calming. It used to be called stimming, and sometimes you still hear that around. But anyway, both of these twins were doing all the things, and it was not looking good. And so I had just come from a conference called Sane Sleep, Allergies, Nutrition, and Environment. And it was a conference to consider those things in your developmental assessments. And so I was like, great, I got this new form. Let's fill it out. And what stood out in the form was these little people, and they were under three, because they were still in birth to three services, was they didn't sleep. Like, they weren't going to sleep until after 10. And then mom had to leave for work really early. So they're getting up at 5 a.m. and not sleeping all day.
Wow.
We're not napping. And I was like, you know what? Nothing else comes up. So we're just going to try this. We're going to start putting them to bed 15 minutes earlier. And we're going to put them to bed. So mom was really well-intentioned, but she was waiting for them to look tired or fall asleep themselves. And so she was just keeping them up and not putting them to bed. So, like I told her, you have to put them to bed. And by, like, the change over a short period of time was incredible. Like, they were unrecognizable as themselves just by getting enough sleep. So, like, that's huge. Sleep helps manage inflammation. It's associated with better school and, you know, school outcomes and cognitive development in children. So I had a mantra when my kids were little is kids who sleep are happy kids. And I was pretty neurotic about getting them to bed and making sure that they were getting appropriate amount of sleep for their age.
Well, that sounds like a good idea. What about food? So are there certain foods? I know you mentioned chemicals before, but there's also chemicals in foods. Are there certain foods that should be avoided or encouraged?
This is one of my favorite topics in the conference, because there is now actually some large data on food. And much to my delight, what has come up is, in general, the best overall diet for most kids in the autism spectrum is just a healthy one. So that's just limiting processed foods, preservatives, additives, those kinds of things, which is doable, because it used to be the big, big, big push was gluten-free, casein-free.
Right.
And it's certainly a lot easier to do now, because there are a lot more gluten-free and casein-free products. But when this all started, it was really hard to get those things. And so
I don't know what casein free is. What is that?
Casein free is a derivative of milk products.
Okay.
That can be inflammatory and reactive in people with autism. And that can, like, if you need it, gluten-free, casein-free can be super helpful. But overall, for the majority, just cutting out, you know, sugary, chemically kinds of foods is the best. And I'm really glad that that was confirmed, because I don't like extreme diets unless they're absolutely necessary. And now the numbers are in my favor.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking to Emily Hall here on the Up Your Brave show. We're talking about everyday ways to support a child with autism. And we've talked about a few, including reducing chemicals, improving sleep. We talked a little bit about diet. Anything else you want to say, Emily, about diet before I move on to something else?
Those are the big things. Like, there are very specific diets like keto, gluten-free, paleo that are helpful for specific symptoms. But that's kind of beyond the scope of what we're talking about today.
Something you've said to me before is autism is a movement problem. So what does that mean exactly? They're not mobile enough or fit?
So there's a disconnect between their motor cortex in their brain and what their body is doing. So the example that I used was the story of the young man and grabbing the hot chips and knowing he should, like, his brain knew he wasn't supposed to do that, but his body did it anyway. So there is a problem, and this is why there can be a lot of misunderstanding about cognition, because many cognitive kinds of tests and activities involve you to move something. Like, you either have to move your mouth and answer a question, or you have to point to something, or you have to build with blocks, or, like, there's something. And this can be a very, very big problem for an individual with autism. So everyday things that families can do, given that that motor movement is such an issue for these individuals, is just move more. Increase the physical activity. Like, if that means just going for a walk and that's what your kid can do, go for a walk. If they are able to like go to the park, go to the beach, these kinds of things. But movement is, like, pivotal for lots and lots of reasons. There are therapeutic movement, like dance therapy, movement therapy, body work, all of these kinds of things that are worth exploring.
I've got a rocket board. I don't know if you've heard of that, but I think that that's possibly an example of a therapeutic movement, or at least I know people with anxiety as well find it very helpful. But it looks like not a surfboard. It's a wooden board that's in house, and it looks like a smile. Okay, I don't know how else to describe it.
Yeah.
And you stand on it with your legs on either side, and you can face forward or you can face sideways. And it's kind of an exercise thing, but it's actually quite therapeutic, just that rocking movement. So is that what you mean by therapeutic movement? Is some sort of rocking in a swing chair or rocket board?
It can be, yeah. All of those things. It's, and I find with this kind of stuff, it's the right thing when it works. And what works for one is not necessarily the best for the other, you know, another. I do have a client who has a swing in her garage, and the swing is, like, awesome therapy. And others, not so much.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love my balance board, or sometimes therapy balls be one example. But what I see more and more is, like, the screen time for all kids, but especially if there's a developmental challenge, is a lost opportunity to move.
Right.
And so being aware of that is something for parents to consider. And going cold turkey or going without, like, it can be, the screen can be an important tool, and some kids use it for communication and all sorts, but also being mindful of, if you're doing that, you're moving very little. And trying to not replace physical activity because of screens.
Is the nature element important as well? Getting them outside. So there's the movement and mobility, but also, like, nature, you know, walking outside, like in nature, rather than just doing something in the yard? Can, like, is there an extra benefit to being in nature, do you think?
This is my personal opinion, not anything that I have research to back up, but I think you could find it, like, through forest bathing and these kinds of movements. Mm-hmm. I think being in nature is really grounding for most kids and for most people, and especially for kids. Comes to mind is, like, when my own son was really little and he was having a tantrum or whatever, we lived in Chicago and there was a lot of cicadas at the time, and that would just stop whatever he was upset about instantly. It was that cicada noise. And I think a lot of kids will have something really magical like that, whether it's like being in water or being at the beach or being amongst the trees, these kinds of things.
Yeah, actually, that leads me really nicely to another question. From your work that you've done, or maybe stories you've heard at the conference, because having an autistic child, obviously it does have a lot of challenges with it, but I think they're also super sensitives in society, and they must bring with them some amazing gifts if those around them, and, not just the parents, but obviously the people that interact with them are open to their gifts. What are your thoughts on that?
I think of all of my clients as just extra sensitive, special people. Mm-hmm. Like, their insights, if you actually stop and listen, they are, like, really amazing, and how intelligent they are, especially about their own bodies, is awe-inspiring. Like, my special people, I always ask them, what do they need treated? Like, what do you want to work on? Even if they're not verbal. And the insight is incredible. If the average, the average functional adult could not do that in a useful way.
What are some things they choose that they want to work on when they come to see you?
Like, I have a client that I've worked with for a long time. And before he ever met me, what he would do when he was upset, and now we know that he has a lot of headaches, but he would take a pen and poke between his toes with the pen. And in acupuncture, that's an awesome way to, like, bring energy out of the head and to reduce headaches and to reduce anxiety and just kind of promote relaxation. And he would do it intuitively. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, like, the family had no idea. They would scold him for doing it.
Yeah.
Because the pen wasn't always necessarily retracted when he would do it. But it's been really beautiful to see how much the dynamic in that family, the relationships have changed when they were just more aware of how intuitive he was of his own needs. And a lot of the things that he was doing were actually really helpful for him, even if they didn't understand it at the time.
Mm. So it's so awesome to have somebody like you that can help to, it is really to enhance the communication or the understanding of, what they're trying to communicate or what they need. And then when the parents realize that, it's like a deeper connection.
So for me, like, my mantra is behavior is communication. Mm-hmm. Behavior is always communication. We may not know off the top of the bat what is trying to be communicated, but the most important thing is to step back and be like, okay, this could be communicating pain, or I'm bored, or I don't like you, or I don't like the situation. Like, it could be communicating a lot of things. I don't know what it communicates, but my job is to step back and ask some questions and to work with the person rather than against them, or do something to them to help figure it out.
For those of you listening, we hope you found some insights, some understanding, or even some practical tips, depending on your situation. We'd love to hear from you. What resonated for you? What was helpful? Or what story would you like to share from your own experience, possibly as or supporting an autistic child? You can send us a text, 2057, or email inbox@realitycheck.radio. Emily, I'd love to ask you, what is coming up that people can maybe learn from, and how can they reach out and connect with you online?
Sure. I have two websites. One is goodbeginningswellness.com. The other one is myfeedingcoach.com. So I have a particular interest with people who have difficulty with the act of eating, mm-hmm. like physically eating, chewing, or swallowing is difficult. And that's, yeah, I'm not very active on social media, those kinds
okay.
of things.
Well, a website is a great way for people to reach out to you. We will put the links to that on the replay page as well. And what is coming up? Do you have any trainings or any other conferences you're heading off to?
Yeah, so April is always International Pediatric Feeding Disorder Month. Conference has been in April for a long time. And this year is no exception. And officially, I am a conference blogger this year for International Pediatric Feeding Disorder.
Amazing. So you're a contributor. Does that mean you're writing for it or you will also be speaking?
I wrote a blog particularly on my interest in medical trauma as it relates to eating disorders.
Mm. Well, that's amazing. Well, congratulations on that. And I know that that's what I love doing is I'm a super connector. I love to put together people that have a certain challenge or problem or opportunity in life that they're looking for with a person that can support them. So I'm hoping that anyone out there that is struggling a little bit in the department of feeding or autism or anything else that Emily is amazing at helping with, you can get in touch with her. Is there anything else you want to share with our audience before we wrap up?
Have hope. There's always something you can do. And most importantly, assume your child is competent and capable. Always assume competence.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Emily, for joining us today. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.